All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Tuesday, March 16th, 2021. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I've participated in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly history magazine. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.com for all the details. All right, with that said, let me introduce our special guest this evening. Lauren Witzke is joining us for the first time. Lauren was the Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate in the state of Delaware in the 2020 election, and also serves as a spokeswoman for the Hold the Line PAC, a conservative political action committee. Lauren, welcome to the program. How are you this evening?
Hi, John. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
Hey, well, I appreciate you agreeing. This worked out pretty quickly. I heard you on the Kill Stream recently, and I've been following your work for really, I guess, since you kind of got involved in politics and ran for office out in Delaware. So I figured I'd reach out and see if you're interested in coming on to talk about your experience running for office and also the Hold the Line PAC and just some more, I guess, current events and what's going on politically in America today. So, just to get started, can you kind of just introduce yourself and talk about how you got involved in politics and ultimately running for the U.S. Senate in Delaware?
Right. Yeah. So I ran for United States Senate in Delaware last year. It was my first time ever running for office. And I initially ran on to end the opioid epidemic. I'm in recovery myself, so I'm really passionate about recovery. And I got sick and tired of our political class not talking about it. Not just the Democrats, but also the Republicans. Nobody was addressing the opioid epidemic, the crisis that had reached epidemic proportions in the United States of America. So I launched a campaign for United States Senate last year, and we broke records. My first time running, I defeated the GOP-endorsed candidate, a lawyer, well-established lawyer in the state of Delaware. Not only beat him, I demolished him in my primary. But then I went on to take on Chris Coons. They buried us in mail-in ballots, 165,000 mail-in ballots for Chris Coons already in the door on Election Day. They ballot harvested from the prisons. We just couldn't defeat it. However, we did break the Delaware record in most GOP Senate candidate votes in Delaware history. So we have a lot to be proud of. We fought really hard, but I'm passionate about politics and passionate about Donald Trump politics. His run for president is kind of what inspired my run.
Interesting. Okay, cool. Yeah. So you were, would you say that was really like your first big political awakening, or have you always been interested in politics? I know looking back at the 2016 election, that really generated a lot of support for politics in general. People that really weren't paying attention too much to politics really became energized and, motivated and sort of started following politics much more closely, I think mostly due to Trump's, candidacy.
Yeah, absolutely. When he challenged the establishment, he talked about real issues that mattered, restricting immigration, building a wall, putting American workers first, taking care of American families first. The idea that to secure our southern border and to protect American families and make life easier for American families, it became such a controversial idea, which is remarkable. But Donald Trump, he talked about it and he ended up defeating the establishment and took it on. So that was what I think was so inspiring about his candidacy in 2000. That's why he won in 2016. It was sad to watch as, he surrounded himself with bad people in his administration. He tried to run his administration, his presidential administration, like a business with opposing ideas. And in the end, it ended up hurting him. He needed people that were going to be loyal to him, loyal to the cause. And as a result, it ended up being his defeat in the end. Some really bad advice told him not to handle the election fraud, to ban vote by mail, you know, to not take the risks that were needed to end abortion in 2018. You know, we had the House, the Senate, and the presidency, and they still signed off on a budget to force taxpayers to fund Planned Parenthood. You know, so many mistakes were made during his administration. However, you know, it was overall inspiring, and it certainly did spark a movement for the future of politics.
Yes, there's no doubt about that. And that's sort of what the America First movement, I think, kind of more broadly is. It's very much inspired by what Trump started in 2016. I wanted to ask you about your actual experience running for office, like the day-to-day. What was your day-to-day schedule like? How did the media treat you? I was reading earlier some hit pieces that came out. You know, a lot of them look like they came out shortly after you locked up the GOP nomination, and then, you know, ultimately advanced to the Senate election against Chris Coons, you mentioned. And I was also looking at the statistics. It looks like you got about 40% of the vote. I mean, officially, I have no doubt that there's been voter fraud for a very long time in this country, and particularly in this election. I think there's all sorts of evidence to show that there was all sorts of fraud, especially with the presidential election. But could you kind of talk about just your experience running for office and how your day-to-day, you know, schedule was, you know, what you were doing every day, and I bring this up because on the Killstream interview, you almost made it seem like it was sort of a fun, like easy thing to do and to kind of jump into, which I thought was very encouraging.
Yeah, well, people think that they have to be a lawyer or a well-established, you know, millionaire in order to run for office. That is a blatant lie. The government was made for people like you and me to run for office. It was made for ordinary Americans to go and represent other ordinary Americans in D.C. So they've kind of taken over that with a lie, saying that you have to be, you know, some well-established, doing it a certain way. We did it completely unusually. I started my campaign with $25. And what I did was I just went out and I fought for what I believed in, and people followed. You know, a majority of people just want somebody who is going to fight for them. Look at Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example. You know, you may not agree with everything she does, but you know that she is fighting for Georgia in D.C. and her voters love her for it. You know, she's trying. So we just went out. What I did was I hosted meet and greets at local pizza parlors. I made them completely free. Hey, come out and hear me speak. And we started booking them out. You know, we had to get to a point where we had to get bigger and bigger venues. And then I just go in, I talk about the consequences of mass immigration. I talk about the consequences of the opioid epidemic, the breakdown of the family. And then at the end, I would ask for donations. And I just did it entirely voluntarily. And we built quite a movement here in the state of Delaware. You know, there really was something rising up here. You know, and it was really inspiring. We had overwhelming support. The hit pieces did come after they realized that I wasn't playing. Like, I was serious and I wasn't here to grift. I was here to win. So I fought really, really hard. Every day I was either door knocking, making phone calls. It's a lot of begging for money. People don't realize the candidate life isn't all that fun and glamorous. You know, there is the fun parts where you do sometimes get to go on the news, or you get, you know, a really good viral tweet or something, and that's fun. But the majority of it is you sitting at home calling people, asking for money, because campaigns are expensive. But, you know, people are willing to give to you if you're willing to fight for them. The immigration moratorium that I ran on got me a lot of nationalist support, you know, securing our southern border, restricting immigration to the point where replacement immigration is stopped. You know, right now we abort 1 million babies a year. We also bring in 1 million migrants a year. It's no coincidence. They're literally replacing the American people. So, you know, if you fight for something and you stand for something, you will gain support. And it's not artificial support either. It's not GOP establishment hacks retweeting your donate link saying, oh, vote for this person. No, this is, we were fighting for something. You know, we were able to push the window on an immigration moratorium to the point where Fair Immigration was talking about how we needed one. Marjorie Taylor Greene is now calling for an immigration moratorium. Which is remarkable. And that is what happens when you get out there. You are fearless and bold and stand for what you believe in, and you become a loud voice and advocate for your cause.
Yeah, that's I couldn't agree with you more. And I mean, the American public is so desperate for authentic, truthful, honest, respectable candidates, and they are few and far between and have been for a very for my entire lifetime. I mean, it is very, very rare to see a political candidate that is that does come across and presents themselves and is genuine, is authentic. And I think Trump did that very, very well. I think Trump was a love him or hate him, he was not some, establishment, politician coming out of the swamp at DC. He was a real authentic man that said what was on his mind and maybe didn't always do so gracefully or, politically correctly as, the media would have would prefer candidates to stay within a certain boundaries, obviously. But yeah, I mean, I think, a candidate like yourself, you mentioned Marjorie Taylor Greene, and there's a few others. There are a few others that have actually, won elections and actually are in Congress now that are very authentic. And I think in your case, I mean, talking so openly about your struggles with opioids and just I guess drugs more generally is very inspiring. It's very courageous, and it's very respectable, and I think people recognize that.
Yeah, my state is crippled by addiction. Our nation is crippled by addiction. So, I found that there was a lot of desperate parents who had children who were addicted. And my message not only became like it wasn't for solutions, but it also gave people hope. Like, if I can overcome this, if I can go from where I was to where I am today, that means that your children don't have to die. Like, your child does not have to die from an overdose or just dissolve their life. Like, there is hope. And that is an inspiring message. You have to give people a reason to support you, a reason to have hope. And in a hopeless time right now, that looks pretty good right now, no matter how like minute it was. I lost my campaign, but you know what? I ran a successful Senate campaign on my first try. And if I can do it, I mean, and it was only 3 years ago. I mean, I've only been clean 3 years. And I haven't, I was just honest. I was like, yeah, I was a drug addict. Yeah, I did this. I did this. I was so dirty. I was so sinful. But God still used me. And, and it's inspiring and it's the truth. And that still applies to everybody else. It doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter where you came from. It does not disqualify you from doing great things. And that is the truth. A lot of people believe, oh, I did this 10 years ago. I could never run for office. I can never be this or that. That is also another lie. Your past and the struggles that you overcome, it makes you a regular person, And everybody struggles with something. Everybody has something in their closet that they don't want to people to know about. You know what? I was just honest. There was nothing they could blackmail me for. And I wanted my voters to know exactly what they were getting. And you know what? They didn't care. They didn't care that I struggled with addiction. They actually liked the fact that I came with a story and a redemption story, which is good, And I wish I'd like to see more of that. I'd like to see more people who have had struggles with regular, ordinary struggles that everyday Americans struggle with, and rising to the top and fighting back against the awful globalist oligarchy that we have that is oppressing us.
Yeah,
Oppression
absolutely.
is the worst thing. For our country, and as our leadership started getting worse, we get worse. And you'll see that with Joe Biden. And I hope you see more fighters who are willing to stand in the gap, and stand for what's right.
Yeah. Well, I think you've, sort of set the tone and paved the way for people to do just that. And I wanted to actually kind of pick your brain a little bit about the drug problem in America. Sort of coming from, you have firsthand experience with this, and you've talked about it, so openly. It is a huge problem. I mean, I remember in high school and college, I had friends that became addicted. Really, it started with just prescription drugs in general, and then it turned into OxyContin. And I mean, I had a couple friends that were, total addicts. I mean, they literally like couldn't, they couldn't really operate without having it. It was like that bad. And I don't know all the details. I mean, I sort of like once they sort of went down that route, I kind of distanced myself and, found other friends and other things to do. But it is a huge problem. And it's whether and now we see, marijuana being legalized all over the country, other drug. I mean, in Oregon, I think like almost any drug is legal. I don't know all the details, but you see this push for either legalization or decriminalization of drugs. And where I'm at in Southern California, I mean, you see this very vividly just driving your car down the street. I mean, there's homeless people and drug addicts everywhere, literally everywhere you go in Southern California, at least in the bigger cities in Los Angeles and San Diego and other parts of Los Angeles County. I mean, it is a huge, huge problem. And I'm sure it's similar in pretty much any other major city. So, I mean, what is the reality of the drug problem in America, and what can we even do about it at this point? What would your solution be like politically to address this problem?
Yeah. So, I'll share a little bit about like my history with addiction, what I saw, what I learned, and how we can fight back. So I started right after college. I got a job for pharmaceutical industry. Let me tell you something. That place is, the pharmaceutical industry is very wicked. First thing they do is they take the drug reps and they send them to charm school, basically. And we learn how to manipulate doctors, get them to write prescriptions we want, get them to write for us. And it's literally charm school. So I kind of bought into that lie that there was like a pill to fix anything. If you have depression, there's a pill for that. If you have anxiety, there's a pill for that. They even came out with a pill for addiction. I remember seeing the marketing for, OxyContin, that it was like, you know, the most unaddictive, least addictive opiate coming out to the market, but it was a blatant lie, you know? And they should be held accountable for that. As a result, it kind of kickstarted the opioid epidemic, which was already rising, due to open borders. But eventually, you know, I started taking pills, and it progressed to methamphetamine and heroin. You know, I was an IV heroin user. I found myself in Tennessee running drugs, low-end drug, like I was a low-end drug runner for the Mexican cartel down there. And, people need to understand that these people come into our country 100% legally, a lot of them. The ones I was working for, they weren't illegal. They were here legally. They were given amnesty here. And this is the kind of people we're allowing into our country. A merit-based system does not currently exist in the United States, so we're bringing people in who will sell drugs to your children that are laced with fentanyl. They know it's laced with fentanyl, and it could potentially kill them, but they have to sell the drugs because they need the money. Like, they have to report back with the money. So they'll sell laced drugs and not think twice about it. They see Americans as very disposable. That's very dangerous. So that was part of the reason that I ran on an immigration moratorium, because we have to build a merit-based system. Not only is it the issue that we're bringing in people that want us dead, essentially, it's also, you know, to the point where wages are low. American students are forced to compete against cheap foreign labor for jobs. Low wages equals not able to afford having a family and children, which equals depression. More and more men, usually it's white men too, are dying of deaths of despair, whether it's suicide, drinking themselves to death, or overdosing on drugs. It really is targeting a demographic of white males in America. You know, and that's concerning. You know, it's very concerning. And nobody wants to talk about it because nobody wants to defend, you know, it especially wasn't acceptable 5 years ago to defend white people. But even now, like, I think they've seen that it's a targeted attack against them. So now we're actually able to actually speak up and be like, hey, like, critical race theory is not okay. Openly calling for the execution of white people, or calling us racist just because we were born with white skin. It's dangerous rhetoric. But anyway, I'm getting off the immigration topic. But however, you know, like, I was able to see firsthand what kind of people were bringing into our country and how they saw us as disposable assets is what they saw us. They're only here for economic reasons. They aren't here to be a part of make America great. And they have to go back. And they have to go back.
Let me just interrupt you real quick and just say, in my experience, the people that, I mean, generally speaking, the people that are coming here, I mean, as you said, they're not here to, you know, become a productive member of society or, you know, assimilate and, you know, champion like American ideals. They're here to exploit our country to make as much money as they can. And they don't care how they do it. These people are incredibly unprincipled and immoral and unscrupulous. I mean, you know, they basically view America as just a marketplace that can be exploited. And we're so gullible and naive and dumb, frankly, to allow this to go on. They're like dumbfounded that it could be this easy for them. I mean, really, if you hear some of the things that these people say, once they're here, it's like, wow, America is just like openly allowing us to do this. And they're giving us, in many cases, giving us benefits, you know, getting on welfare, housing assistance. I mean, it goes on and on and on. We're bending over backwards to, you know, basically to allow illegals and other people that shouldn't even be here in the first place to take over the country, to, you know, exploit it, to benefit themselves while hurting our own country and hurting our own people. It's absolutely insane.
Right. Yeah. And it's true. You know, they don't consider this their home. They consider this a place for them to make money. And that's the truth. And, you know, they do a really good job. The left does a really good job building a narrative. So what they do is they photograph and they funnel little children at the border. And then they have, you know, the kids in cages. You know, it's a narrative. Like, nobody wants kids in cages. Like, nobody normal. It doesn't sit right with anybody. But that's the deal. Like, they create the narrative that's little children coming into the country that are desperately fleeing the cartels. But no, actually, what we're doing is we're opening the doors wide open to these cartels because they're the ones trafficking them in. And then we're giving them amnesty. And they recycle these children back and forth. And many of them are molested or raped and or sold into human trafficking. And but the narrative, if you look at the news, it's like, oh, we have to save these little children from this, you know, horrible, horrible Mexico. That's not the case at all. You know, it's how they manipulate the populace into opening our borders wide open to people who want us dead. They just put a really good bow package on it to make it look good with the children. And it's all a lie. You know, I saw it firsthand. You know, these weren't kids that were coming in. These were grown men. And they're dangerous. And, they like slit people's throats. After I went to rehab, I ended up making the decision to go to rehab. And I found out that like two of my friends got their head chopped off, and they were left in a graveyard down in Tennessee. Like, you know, it's the cartels that are doing this to people. American people. By the grace of God, I was able to get out. Yeah, I was able to get out in time, you know, and turn my life around. It was totally a God thing. Like, he just saved me. People are like, how did you get out alive? You're like, you know, he just saved me. And, you know, I'm grateful for that. But, you know, that's the only answer I have, you know, but I also had to like submit to the process of recovery and make the decision to leave my life behind and change. You know, which is the hard part. Recovery is hard. It's not supposed to be easy. It's not supposed to be comfortable. I went away for a year to rebuild my character and get my life straight. However, you know, a lot of my friends died. A lot of them died. I was able to get a couple of them into the rehab that I went to after I became the program director of it. Like, I went and like reached out to all the people that were still alive that were left. I was like, hey, listen, I have this program for you. I can get you in for free. And like, I was able to pull a couple of my friends out, but many of them didn't make it. Many of them died when I was still in rehab. Many of them were sold laced drugs when I was in rehab. A couple of them got their heads chopped off. Like, it's just, it's crazy. It's absolutely insane what is going on with our country. And the thought of just, hey, maybe we should stop bringing these people in and take care of Americans and American families and get a handle of this opioid epidemic. But that's controversial. Like, they say,
right. What a radical, crazy, like racist idea, right?
Right. It's not. It's really.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. It's insulting. It's ridiculous. It's unacceptable. You know, and for anybody to, you know, to back down from that is just, it's just cowardly. It's like, look, we need to be adults here and recognize what is going on in this country. So what I'm picking up from what you're saying about this is the drug problem in America is fundamentally tied to our immigration problems, right?
Mm-hmm.
That seems to
yes,
be,
absolutely.
That's obvious. Well, so, I mean, well, besides, you know, ending immigration, which I completely support, I know you ran on it. I think it was a 10-year moratorium on any sort of immigration into this country. Like, I 100% agree with that, and I'd probably argue it should be even longer than 10 years. But I mean, what is a good strategy, or what like sort of public policies would you champion or advocate for if you were in office, or even now, you know, running your running the Political Action Committee. Because here, well, and let me just, before I let you answer, in California, what I see is they want to throw money at the situation. They want to throw money at rehab centers, throw money at, you know, setting up like homeless shelters and stuff like this without ever actually addressing the root problem. So it's like just facilitating this degenerate, you know, drug-fueled lifestyle that a lot of these people have. It's not actually getting them off drugs and you know, getting them to engage in sort of any sort of productive work or anything like, or, you know, getting their life back on track. It's basically just facilitating it at the end of the day.
Yeah, it absolutely is. What they do is they try to put a Band-Aid on it. You know, they fund Suboxone clinics, which have a 1%, 1 to 9% success rate. You know, people do not recover. What they're doing is they're not giving solutions. They're just putting Band-Aids over issues. You know, hey, you know, people need, you know, it's hard to hire this time of year. Let's import the third world. You know what I'm saying? Like, the answer is never a real solution. They present falsehoods. And, you know, as a result, it's destroying our social fabric. You know, like I said before, mass migration, it pushes wages down. It also pushes our birth rates down because men are forced to compete against cheap foreign labor for these jobs. They are forced to compete against Indian guest workers who will work for 12 hours for half the price. We cannot compete with cheap foreign labor, especially those that come in illegally and work under the table. You know, it's absolutely impossible. So as a result, men are not able to provide for their families. They're not able to have children. They can't afford it, which leads to the breakdown of the family, which leads to moms being forced to depend on the state, which incentivizes the breakdown of the family. So moms will lose their benefits should they choose to get married. It keeps, everything is deliberately assigned to keep fathers out of the home and keep the family separated. You know, I also ran on restoring the nuclear family, diverting welfare money to incentivize marriage and family. So not just incentivizing single parenthood, because, you know, when you incentivize it, people respond to incentives. They do. You know, we incentivize the breakdown of the family. And guess what? Now we're a global leader in single parenthood. You know, that just goes to show, that's proof right there. And as a result, children that grow up in single parent homes are more likely to start using drugs. Like, I think it's like 60% more likely to partake in sexual promiscuity, to be more impressionable. You know, right now we have a sexualized, charged generation of media who's going after the young generation. You know, and it's just, it's easier to target kids when the parents are not together. So, you know, they've come up with all these pills, like for solutions for the opioid epidemic. But really, we have to rebuild our social fabric, restrict immigration, take care of families first, and talk about the hard issues. You know, it's not a popular topic to tell moms or single moms, hey, listen, like, I want to divert this money so you don't lose your benefits when you get married. Well, what, do you have a problem with single motherhood? No, I have a problem with the statistics of it. You know, the statistics say that your child is going to grow up more likely to be depressed, more likely to use drugs, more likely, you know, and I'm not, and this is statistically speaking, you know, and, you know, we can reverse the trend, but we have to have people that are willing to call it out and fight for it. You know, I would love to be able to restore the American nuclear family. Being a global leader in single parenthood isn't something to be proud of. It's not. You know, we're the United States of America. We were founded on families. We were founded on strong families. So when our families are in crisis, our nation is in crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. Very well said. And this has been a problem for decades now. I mean, it's obviously, you know, sort of spiraling out of control at this point, but it's been a problem for a number of years. And that's, I think it's important, you know, to be openly talking about this stuff and addressing it, you know, head on, not, you know, beating around the bush and being honest about it, and also bringing real world, real life experience to the issues, like, you know, as you've sort of been talking about. And you mentioned how you were involved in the pharmaceutical industry. This is something I also know a little bit about. I've never been, you know, directly involved in it, but I've sort of seen it, you know, just friends that are acquaintances, people that I've met over the years. And I completely agree with your assessment of it, how it's totally soulless, and it's, you know, they try to manipulate people, manipulate doctors to get their drugs in circulation. And really, I've come to view like our modern health and medical paradigm as being fundamentally flawed in the sense that, you know, rather than focusing on what actually keeps people healthy, which is simply exercising, eating good food, drinking water, getting good sleep, getting out, you know, outdoors, getting sunshine, like the basics, none of that is even discussed or talked about. And this is clearly on display with this whole COVID quote unquote pandemic. I think it's a totally politically manufactured pandemic. I don't know what your take is on it, but I mean, you see how none of this is even discussed with this COVID situation. It's all about, oh, you got to go take your vaccine. We got to, you know, have lockdowns and you put your mask on, which is totally unhealthy and totally harmful, especially for children. I mean, these kids are going to school wearing their mask all day. It's an outrageous and insane situation, and yet it passes for like legitimate public policy these days. It's crazy.
Yeah, and you know, they were warned before this, you know, that suicide rates were going to go up. They were warned that overdose rates were going to go up. They almost doubled last year. I didn't lose any friends to COVID, but I lost a friend to relapse, my best friend. Actually, she was my counselor at the rehab I was at. Like, she's my mentor. She was my friend. And she ended up, you know, she was stuck in the New York lockdowns where they locked down everything. She came isolated. Isolation is not good for a people. You know, we are community driven people. We need to be around other people. She isolated, she got depressed. She ended up going out one day and just saying, I'm going to go use drugs, immediately overdosed and died. You know, so what they have done is so evil to the American people. They shut down their businesses. People are on food bank lines, and they lied to us just so they could pass vote by mail and steal an election. It was always their agenda. It was always politically motivated. Right. And it's sickening. It's absolutely disgusting. You know, and these people are, a lot of elected officials are bought and paid for by Big Pharma. Chris Coons especially, they poured millions of dollars into his campaign. You know, they have to preserve their people and they'll never speak out. They'll never like speak out against the people, the hand that feeds them ever. You know, so they'll just keep enabling it. So it's partially our elected officials are to blame for allowing it to happen. However, you know, it was always an agenda and it was so evil and it was so wicked. And I think like 90,000 people died of drug overdoses last year, just from the lockdowns. When we finally started getting it kind of under control, I think it was like 50,000 the year before, it like almost doubled. And it's, they were warned. They were told this would happen. Suicides, kids, and suicides are skyrocketing because they're isolated. You know, they knew that this would happen and they chose to do it anyway.
Oh yeah. There's clearly a major tyrannical globalist agenda behind the whole COVID, you know, fake pandemic situation, no doubt about it. And I think, you know, you sort of alluded to it. I think a key part of it, you know, going back, it's been a year, go back to a year from now. And it was to facilitate the theft of the 2020 election and allow the Democrats to steal it. And I mean, they even basically openly admit this. And if you read certain publications, there was an incredibly obvious, like blatantly obvious article written in Time magazine, basically detailing how the election was stolen. I don't know if you caught that, but I can't remember the name of it off, like the title of it off the top of my head, but you know, you read that and it's like, oh wow, they're basically like sort of outlining and celebrating how they were able to do this, but they totally flipped the script and they call it like securing democracy. You know, it's so Orwellian the way they do these things. And
they bragged about it. That's the most terrifying thing, is they couldn't help themselves. They had to make sure that they got the credit. Like, yes, we rigged the election. Yes, we did it. But you need to know that it was us, because they're proud of what they've done. You know, they're trying to provoke us. I know the end result, like what they want, like with the silencing of conservatives, like the mass silencing of conservatives, the propping up of pedophilia, the propping up of wearing three masks or don't go out in public. You know, like all this stuff, it's certainly Orwellian. That's a good way to phrase it. But also, you know, they want us. They want us. They want civil discourse. They want, you know, what happened at the Capitol. They didn't have enough at the Capitol to really like claim it was an insurrection. They know that. But they were able to take a little small piece of people just entering the Capitol building and turn it into a giant terrorist attack. You know, the FBI is calling me now, and they just called me the other day because I attended the Capitol rally wanting to ask me questions. You know, and it's like, you know, they're using Joe Biden's DOJ is literally using the Capitol rally, or if you supported President Trump, as political persecution against conservatives. You know, this is America. We have rights, but not anymore, it doesn't seem. You know, it seems like they can do anything. You know, people, I know a few people that didn't even go inside the Capitol have been arrested after cooperating with the FBI. To anybody listening, don't cooperate with the feds. Don't talk to them. You have a right to remain silent. You don't owe them anything unless they're there to ask them. Are you here to arrest me? No, then get off my property, because they are trying to set people up. What they do is they say, oh, you're not a target. You're not a target. But then they will interview you enough to maybe catch you in a lie and pull General Flynn on you and get you locked up. You know, these people are specifically targeting conservatives. They're trying to make an example out of Trump supporters. We are being politically persecuted in our own country.
Yes. Yeah. Very well said. And again, this is something that's been going on for a long time, including, sadly, under the Trump administration. I mean, every year, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, would release their annual threat assessment. And they always specifically pointed out or targeted, quote unquote, white supremacists and, you know, conspiracy theorists and Trump supporters, basically, as like the greatest threat facing the country. Meanwhile, the radical left, BLM, Antifa, have been openly engaging in like a legitimate violent insurrection against the country. You know, legitimate, you know, rioting and looting and outright terrorism. And this goes back to when Trump was running for office back in 2015 and into 2016. You couldn't even go to a rally without being attacked and having, you know, projectiles thrown at you, getting, you know, liquids dumped on you, getting beat up and harassed by these radical left-wing terrorists. And the government is not concerned at all with these people. They are, you know, if they do get arrested, they're, you know, let out the next day and they're not even prosecuted or even really investigated. So it's a very...
Did you know they are holding these people that entered the Capitol for trespassing without bail? Like, they aren't even granted bail.
Yeah, that's what I mean,
bail.
Yeah. Like, yeah, so compare that to what we just saw all of 2020 with BLM and Antifa. And again, this goes back well before even 2020. I mean, 2020 was like on steroids, you know, the violent left-wing insurrection against the country. And again, I think that all ties in with this fake COVID pandemic and with this agenda to steal the election from Trump. It's part of the broader like color revolution American style by the same exact people that carry these operations out overseas. And you know, it's so clear and it's so obvious, and people have been pointing this out and documenting it, and it's just, you know, it happened, you know, still it happened right here in America. And you're right. I mean, these people that well, I guess, you know, you sort of given your take on the Capitol, quote unquote, insurrection. This weekend, I finally watched the entire thing. I watched Millie Weaver's documentary, PSYOP the Steal. And I found it incredibly compelling. I mean, I think there were a lot of genuine people involved in the Capitol protest. But I think what we saw in the media was basically a PSYOP designed to set up the, you know, the America First pro-Trump conservative movement and to, you know, allow the FBI and the Biden administration to go after these people, to go after anybody that is a skeptic or a political dissident in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's to target conservatives. They're trying to make an example out of us. And, you know, people are now Trump supporters are too scared to go to D.C. now. You know, they've had an excuse to fortify the Capitol, to keep their constituents out. The biggest thing they fear is being confronted by their constituents on their way to the bathroom, which is our right. You know, and they're passing all this legislation. They're signing these executive orders. They're destroying America, and they're doing it behind a barbed wire fence, and we aren't able to hold them accountable. You know, everything's an opportunity with them to paint us as domestic terrorists when really we're just law-abiding citizens who want our voices to be heard. You know, the election was stolen right out from underneath of us, and people went there to the Capitol to have their voices heard. The majority of people just wanted to talk to their elected officials because they've been ignoring them, and they were about to certify a fraudulent election. However, you know, what they did, the system is rigged. You know, it is terrifying what they have done to us. You know, I hope I don't look back 10 years from now and think I have it pretty good now. You know, I look around me and I'm watching my country deteriorate, and I'm watching them just blatantly take power, blatantly take control, and instill communism on our country while they do it behind a barbed wire fence. And we can't even fight back because they'll throw us in prison.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, we are seeing a total in-your-face medical tyranny unfold with this COVID situation. It's not even medical. I mean, it's just political. It's everything. I mean, you can't even voice your opinion online these days. I mean, you were just banned on Twitter, if I'm not mistaken, just the other day. And so this censorship agenda is, you know, unfolding very rapidly, increasingly more so. So it's really out of control. And I think it's going to take genuine, authentic people like you to stand up and say these things and to run for office and to get involved politically and to start political action committees, including, for example, Hold the Line. I want to plug this real quick. I know we're going to wrap up here in a minute. HoldTheLinePack.com. is the PAC that you're officially a spokeswoman for? Is that like your official title? I wasn't sure exactly.
So I'm the spokeswoman for Hold the Line PAC. So I want to be able to fight back. In order to do that, I'm building networks. I'm building communities. I'm fighting for causes right now. I'm fighting for election integrity. You know, we're trying to push through 8 election reform bills in Georgia. You know, I'm going state to state to state to ban vote by mail. You know, the only way we can cut people like Stacey Abrams off at the knees, the only way we can cut off these nonprofits from ballot harvesting from the prisons is if these ballots don't exist in the first place. You can't ballot harvest from somewhere when ballots don't exist. So we're fighting to end vote by mail. The ballot drop boxes, requiring voter ID. Like, all of this is just what civilized societies do. Civilized societies don't use vote by mail. They actually don't even use electronic voting machines. Look at what happened to Venezuela. You know, we need to go back to paper ballots. But that's what I'm going to do first, is restore election integrity. I'm going to get what I want. And then from there, I'm going to be supporting elected officials and America First candidates who will go to D.C. and fight for us, who will no longer, you know, just kind of give us lip service while our country is being dismantled. And that's what I'm doing.
Good. Well, you seem to be doing a very good job. So I tip my hat to you. And I'm really just impressed with you in general, your honesty, your integrity, you know, your genuineness. You really are, you know, you're a real person with flaws, with things that have happened in the past and issues you've gotten into, but you've been open and honest about it. And I think that's very courageous and commendable. So keep up the good work, Lauren, and thank you very much for coming on the program. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you giving me a voice when everybody else has silenced me. So thank you, John.
Yes, no problem. And I will be in touch, and maybe we can do this again down the line.
Absolutely, for sure. Thank you, John.
Okay, take care, Lauren.